live from WKAR. It's live music. Thursday? Hey, we're a day earlier than usual here today. Usually it's live music Friday here on Current State, but we want to commemorate the 4th annual Mighty Uke Day, which is coming up here in Lansing. So that's scheduled to start tomorrow. So we are welcoming Andy Wilson there, doing Satin Doll, if I'm not mistaken, there on the ukulele. Pardon me. Andy Wilson. We'll also hear from Ben Hassinger, the founder of Mighty Uke Day. Ben's also on the ukulele, and Steve Zalige will be accompanying these guys as well on upright bass, and we'll be learning about everything going on for Mighty Uke Day coming up here in Lansing beginning tomorrow. Later on in our program, learn about the extraordinary work being done on the streets of downtown East Lansing by a world-renowned artist from Pakistan, Imran Qureshi. Spoke with our Scott Pohl, and we'll be hearing that interview coming up. You may have seen Imran Qureshi's work on the streets of East Lansing already in alliance with his work at the Broad Art Museum in East Lansing. At the top of our program today, 1 in 5 women is sexually assaulted in college. That's the opening statement in a 20-page report released by the White House last week to address the apparent epidemic of sexual assault on our nation's college campuses. Last week, the U.S. Department of Education also revealed the names of the 55 colleges and universities that the agency is investigating for how they handle sexual assault complaints. As we know, the University of Michigan and Michigan State University were on that list. Here with us now to discuss the report, which was compiled by the White House Task Force to Protect Students from Sexual Assault, Sherry Murgatroyd is the program coordinator for the MSU Counseling Center's Sexual Assault Program, and we welcome Sherry back to Current State.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. What's your overall reaction to the report, Sherry?
My overall reaction is one of being very impressed with the research and the amount of time and thoughtfulness that went into the task force report. It's clear that we have national advocates and people at the White House really caring about this issue and doing a lot of investigating about what the needs are for victims and for universities to increase safety on campus and hold perpetrators accountable. I think what stuck out to me the most was the guidelines around confidentiality and maintaining confidentiality when victims wish to disclose to resources or personnel, faculty or staff on campus without worrying about that confidential information going any further. A lot of employees are mandatory reporters on campus, so if someone discloses a sexual assault to them, they're required to report to our OCR office, our Office for Civil Rights, which is the Office for Inclusion, and also the police. So maintaining confidentiality for therapists and advocacy personnel and crisis line workers is really important. So
why is it important?
So victims know that they can go to a resource or someone on campus who understands sexual assault and let them know that they have indeed been sexually assaulted and they need help. They may not be ready to report to the university. They may not be ready to report to the police. We know most victims do not report to the police. Only about 20% actually report, which is a huge problem.
How widespread are those confidentiality standards right now? I mean, some places they're implemented, other places they're not?
Right. Actually, in the state of Michigan, advocates and crisis counselors are protected by confidentiality laws. We don't have to disclose any information to universities. And our university at Michigan State recognizes advocates, sexual assault advocates and crisis line workers and therapists, of course, as confidential resources. But not all colleges and universities have had that policy. And this report, the task force report, makes it very clear that universities can protect that confidentiality and victims, students who are victims of sexual assault have a place to go for, you know, confidential consultation and emotional support.
One of the first things the report recommends is a campus climate survey. Why is that important?
Well, it's really important for university officials to get a sense of what's happening on the campus and what students are experiencing. So I think the climate surveys are very important. They're critical. Michigan State University actually conducted its first climate survey around domestic violence, relationship violence, and sexual assault back in 2009. From that report, we were able to see that many students coming onto campus were not aware of the resources for sexual assault and for relationship violence. We have just implemented and sent out a new survey to students in the spring of 2009 to, again, assess the climate on our campus around sexual assault and relationship violence. That was conducted by a consortium on campus called Violence-Free Communities by Design. Many agencies and departments on campus come together and we're trying to prevent violence on campus. So that was a product of that consortium, and we're really excited to see that data unfold and
so we've actually measured the climate on campus twice now? Is that what you're saying?
Okay. Yes.
All right.
So we're ahead of the game there.
Okay. The report also recommends training for upper-level administrators. Tell us about the importance of that,
well,
in your view.
In my view, this is important for all colleges and universities to have that trauma-informed training and education for top officials who really sign off on policies and procedures that impact victim safety and perpetrator accountability and resources for victims on campus. So having people at the top who really make the decisions and can uphold the decisions, understand victim response and what trauma-informed response means and the importance of victim safety, that's critical to people doing the work on the ground and meeting with those students and holding perpetrators accountable through the judicial system or through investigation processes.
We're talking with Sherry Murgatroyd here on Current State. Sherry is responding to the White House report from last week, dealing with sexual assault on America's college campuses. This came from the White House Task Force to Protect Students from Sexual Assault. There's also a lot about increasing transparency here, particularly on the part of universities and the federal government. What is transparency like right now in terms of how cases of sexual assault are handled on an administrative level?
Well, right now, universities across the nation are required to report any crime that happens on campus through the Clery Report Act. And so there is that transparency of how many reports are handled on campus, how many disclosures are made to university officials. However, that is so low. Again, only 20% at best of victims report to officials or law enforcement. So even though there's a transparency there and we can see how many reports have been made, it's so low.
If transparency reflects only a small percentage of what's really going on, then
it's not realistic.
How do we deal with the reporting issue?
How do we deal with it?
Yeah, I mean, how do we get more victims to report?
I think this is what the White House Task Force is indeed going to accomplish. I think when students can see that there is a comprehensive, coordinated response on campus to handle investigations, confidential resources, and they feel supported by top university officials and campus officials overall, they will be more comfortable coming forward and reporting more. So I think that we're going to see this trend in the next decade of many more students reporting sexual assault, men and women. We know that men experience sexual assault as well.
So we've talked about the campus climate survey, the confidentiality, training for upper-level administrators, increasing transparency. Overall, where does MSU stand on those four? When you lump them all together, how do we stand here at Michigan State, do you think?
I think we are ahead of the game. We're a leader, actually, with responding to sexual assault. Our confidential programs have been in place for 35 years. The sexual assault program's been in place for 35 years. And we've had the mandatory incoming workshops for freshmen coming onto campus. They are required to attend a two-hour workshop to really help prevent sexual assault and relationship violence. It provides education for them. We also have an e-learning that goes out through the Office for Inclusion. So before freshmen students come on campus, they're required to watch a video about sexual assault and sexual harassment.
And it is mostly underclassmen that are impacted by sexual assault. Am I correct?
You are correct. Actually, this report reveals a lot of research and current trends that I think will really help officials, but we can tell by this report and research involved that the first 2 years of college are really the most vulnerable for women. And that's the freshman and sophomore year that we see more assaults happening with that population. So knowing that the freshman year, that they're getting a lot of education and understanding the resources and confidential locations where they can disclose sexual assault is key.
And so where here at Michigan State would you suggest that we focus? Is there a weak link in the chain here at Michigan State, in your view, in any of these kind of measurements or initiatives?
Well, I feel like we're working together very collaboratively as far as the investigators and the police and victim service agencies in general. I think what we can do is promote the resources more, the confidential resources on campus, and encourage students to come forward and receive that trauma help. Therapy is really important after a sexual assault. Most people end up with post-traumatic stress disorder after a rape. It's a very violent crime. Students need to know where they can come because it will impact their learning, their academic career. It will impact their ability to concentrate or sleep, and it's important that they know where to come. So I think the confidential resource piece, we can promote that more and make that in the forefront for students coming onto campus.
Confidentiality.
Yes.
Okay. Critics of the report, and there are critics of this report, and they argue that its recommendations pose a challenge to right to due process for the accused to face his or her accuser. What do you make of that?
Well, every university is going to be implementing their own investigative process. There is a chance for both parties to be interviewed and share evidence and go through that investigative process. If someone is found responsible for the investigative process, then it generally moves on to a judicial hearing board where sanctions are issued. But it is difficult to investigate these cases. We know that it's hard to hold perpetrators accountable because evidence isn't always there. It turns into a he said, she said kind of conversation, and there's no witness to sexual assault. That's why it's so hard to hold. Most of the time, there's no witnesses involved in sexual assault or rape, so it's really hard to hold perpetrators accountable. And I think that university officials really have their work cut out for them to ensuring that everyone's rights are upheld during that process. For me, the good news is that we're focusing more on perpetrator accountability now than the victim blaming or the victim response. In the past, we spent so much time asking what the victim did to deserve this that it was really challenging to hold perpetrators accountable. This White House Task Force report really focuses on accountability to increase victim safety and public safety on our college campuses.
Well, I think what you're saying also, you can't look at this issue for too long without the alcohol use and drug use entering into the picture. What role does that, doesn't that muddle this situation a lot?
Well, what we know is that alcohol and recreational drugs are often used as a way to make people vulnerable,
sure,
men and women vulnerable. And that can make it very challenging with respect to memory and being able to recall exactly what happened. So alcohol is used in more than 70% of cases around sexual assault where either the victim has been drinking or the perpetrator is drinking or they're intentionally getting the victim to drink alcohol.
Okay. Now, other critics, most prominently Christina Hoff Summers at the American Enterprise Institute, the conservative think tank, have taken issue with that statistic. 1 in 5 women sexually assaulted in college. They say that's way too high. From your vantage point on the ground here, Sherry, dealing with victims on a day-to-day basis, do they have a point? Could 1 in 5 be too high in an estimate?
Not when we're talking about sexual assault. I would say that it's actually higher. It's more likely to be 1 in 3. Sexual assault is any unwanted touching. Okay, sexual assault does include rape, but
it does include men as well. Correct?
Yes, yes. We're talking about men and women who experience sexual assault, and a lot of national stats from the CDC, the Center for Disease Control, or the Department of Justice indicate that widespread, 1 in 4 women will experience sexual assault in their lifetime, and 1 in 6 men will experience sexual assault in their lifetime. Mm-hmm. So sexual assault can be any unwanted touching, and I think that 1 in 5 is pretty low when we look
really
at what that entails.
Overall, Sherry, what does a report like this tell you about the views in our larger, in the country, towards sexual assault?
Well, I think the report is putting us in the right direction because for decades, again, the focus has been on, there's been a lot of victim blaming and lack of accountability for perpetrators who commit sexual assault. We know that very few men commit sexual assault. The offenders, about 6%, according to Dr. David Lisak's research, who is an expert in our country, only about 6% of men commit sexual assault. They're the ones that are committing it against men and women. This report really moves the direction of engaging men and really reaching out to underserved populations and changing our perspective of holding perpetrators accountable. And I think that's really key for keeping our campuses safe and all of our students in a learning environment where they can attend college and go to classes and feel safe on campus.
Sherry Murgatroyd is the program director for the MSU Counseling Center's Sexual Assault Program. Sherry, thanks for joining me to talk about the new White House report on sexual assault on college campuses.
My pleasure.
When the red robin comes bobbing along, there'll be no more sobbing when he starts throbbing his old sweet song. Wake up, you sleepyhead. Get up, get out of bed. Cheer up, the sun is red. Live, love, laugh and be happy. What if I've been blue? Now I'm walking through fields. Flowers, rain may glisten, but still I listen for hours and hours. I'm just a kid again, doing what I did again, singing a song. When the red robin comes bop, bop, bobbing along.
The ukulele-driven sounds there of Ben Hassinger, Andy Wilson, and Steve Zolaiji. Ben is the founder of Mighty Uke Day, which is launches tomorrow here in Lansing. We'll be hearing more from them throughout the hour and learn more about what's going on Mighty Uke Day coming up before the end of our hour. It's Current State here on 90.5 WKAR, the first ever United States report card on physical activity for children and youth, was released last week. With a grade of D- for overall physical activity, there is plenty of room for improvement. The report also focuses on the behavioral and environmental influences which shape a child's physical activity habits. Joe Eisenman is an assistant professor of sports and cardiovascular nutrition at Michigan State University's College of Osteopathic Medicine. Joe served on the committee that commissioned the report, and he joins us now to break down the grades. Hi, Joe.
Hi, Mark. Happy to be here.
You know, we're glad you're here. And what was the motive behind compiling this report exactly?
So part of the motive is our friends across the border in Canada have issued a similar report card for the past 5+ years. And this month in Toronto, there is a global summit on physical activity and health of children in which several countries around the world will also issue a physical activity report card. So that's part of the reason why this report card was issued. And also, there's a lot of timeliness to it as well, obviously, given the childhood obesity epidemic and a lot of concern for physical activity levels of children in the United States.
What were the different aspects of physical activity that you attempted to measure? And talk to us about the indicators that might influence kids' physical activity.
Sure. So that's kind of a two-part question there. The first thing is we examined several indicators. You know, first and foremost is the overall physical activity level. So how much moderate to vigorous intensity physical activity children and adolescents are getting per day, but also looking at the flip side of that, and that's sedentary behavior or inactivity, and then also other components of it, including active transport, sport, active play, and then how different other factors can influence that, including family and peers, what's called the built environment or parks, and other avenues for physical activity. Those are also graded as well.
active transport. This is just how young kids get around, whether they pedal a bike or run or walk or do something other than ride in the backseat of a car, kind of thing.
Exactly.
Yeah. The report card is being called the first of its kind, yet sedentary kids have been on our collective radar for some years now. Should what you studied have been studied sooner?
Well, it has been studied for, several decades now. Several researchers have been actively involved in research of physical activity in children, either looking at the levels of activity or relating the level of activity to certain health indicators.
I'm still not clear on what makes this study the first of its kind.
Sure. So, again, this is a compilation of all of that research over time. But more importantly, there's researchers on this campus or at different universities across the U.S. where they may study just a small cohort of children, whereas a main feature of this report is using nationally representative data. So, for example, our taxpaying dollars pay for a few large national surveys in this country. One is called NHANES, National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey, and another one is called the Youth Risk Behavior Survey. So using data from those reports and sitting down and using a rubric, so not just expert opinion, but using a rubric where we graded each of the indicators based on the prevalence of activity, inactivity, so on and so forth.
Well, our grade was nothing to write home about. Overall physical activity had the grade of D-. Go with us a little deeper into that. How and why did we fare so poorly?
It's kind of the state of the nation, so to speak. And also, if you look at adults don't do much better. And obviously, there's a lot of things that have happened, especially in the past generation, that probably plays into this as well. We've basically socialized physical activity out of our culture. So there's a lot of ways to be sedentary now. There's a lot of technology that comes into play there and whatnot. So again, there's a lot of factors that come into play there. Obviously, a lot of room for improvement.
One stat that just screamed out at me, this was in a story about your study, from the New Orleans Times-Picayune, the percentage of children engaging in moderate to vigorous activity, and here we're talking kids 6 to 11 years of age, moderate to vigorous activity at least 5 days a week, 42%, that's less than half. But you go up to the 12 to 15-year-old group, that drops to 8%.
Right.
Fewer than 1 in 10.
So there's a lot of factors that come into play there, and not all of them are social or environmental. Part of it is just natural biology as well. You can look across all animal species, and when they go from childhood into adolescence to adulthood, physical activity levels decline. So there's some biological underpinnings to that.
But technology obviously plays a huge role.
Certainly,
here too.
We can't ignore social factors or environmental factors either. And one piece that probably needs a little bit more attention is youth sport as well. So if we look at youngsters, 6 to 11 years of age or whatever, a lot of them are engaged in youth sport. Youth sport is a big outlet for physical activity, whether it be organized or unorganized. And if we look at, the adolescent age group, that's when we get into middle school and high school, when kids are getting cut from sport. And so if youth sport is a outlet for physical activity, and now adolescents are not allowed that opportunity to continue to pursue physical activity through sport, it plays part into the decline in activity of adolescents.
Does it fall to the schools? Does it fall to elected officials? Who does it fall to maybe beef that up?
I think it really falls upon all of us. I mean, when we look at this, it's a real complex behavior. There's obviously personal choices to be active, but it goes all the way to, the government level as well in terms of policies, procedures. Obviously, the schools come into play there. If we go back to the youth sport thing, and now if we talk about cutting kids from, a high school basketball team or whatever, what's their outlook going to be? And people always bring up intramural sport, but, who's going to organize that? Where are we going to find the gym space for that? So on and so forth. So, It becomes a complex matter, but obviously it's also an important issue where we need to think of solutions because of the consequences that physical inactivity across the lifespan has.
Remind us what those are. I mean, how does this come back to harm folks?
Sure. There's a myriad of consequences that range from, you know, physical aspects such as increased risk of cardiovascular disease, diabetes, cancers, to mental aspects as well, depression, anxiety, and even going back to the school piece again, you know, a lot of people with the inactivity in children will point to physical education. Number one, it's not the magic bullet. If we put physical education back in schools, it's not going to cure the childhood obesity epidemic or the physical inactivity epidemic. It's going to be a part of it, but, you know, there's several other factors that need to come into play as well. So, you know, getting back to the consequence thing here with schools and cutting physical education and even recess in lieu of standardized tests and doing well in math and science, we know that there are these relationships between physical activity and cognition and a lot of neurocognitive processes.
Joe Eisenman has been our guest. Joe's an assistant professor of sports and cardiovascular nutrition here at Michigan State University. We've been getting his take on the first ever United States report card on physical activity for children and youth. Thank you, Joe.
Thank you.
Daydream. What a day for a daydreaming boy. And I'm lost in a daydream, dreaming about my bundle of joy. And even if time ain't really on my side, it's one of those days for taking a walk outside. I'm blowing the day to take a walk in the sun, follow my face in somebody's new mowed lawn. I've been having a sweet dream, been dreaming since I woke up today. Start me and my sweet thing, 'cause she's the one that makes me feel this way. And even if time has passed me by a lot, I couldn't care less about the dues you say I got. Tomorrow I'll pay the dues for dropping my load. I'll pine the face for being a sleepy bulldog.
Ben Hassinger on lead vocals and ukulele, Andy Wilson on harmonica, Steve Zalaiji on upright bass. We have a ukulele-driven sound to current state here today to commemorate Mighty Uke Day, which starts tomorrow in Lansing. It's the fourth annual. We'll talk with these guys about what's going on in just a few minutes. You've got current state here on WKAR. Thank you very much for joining us. A world-renowned artist from Pakistan got more than he bargained for when he accepted an invitation to display his work at MSU's Broad Art Museum. And current state Scott Pohl is here with the story of Imran Qureshi. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Mark. Broad Art Museum curator Allison Gass has wanted to bring Imran Qureshi to East Lansing practically from the time she arrived at the museum 2 years ago. His reputation has only grown during that time, with major installations at places like the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York. Along with bringing existing pieces to the Broad, he's created site-specific works here. The exhibition is called The God of Small Things. On top of that, he's also accepted an invitation to create what's being called crack art for a project called Fragmented on the streets of East Lansing. You can see photos of both of these projects right now at WKAR.org. I spoke with Qureshi yesterday about what drew him to these installations in East Lansing.
I think when I got invitation from the deputy director and the curator of the museum, Allison Gass, I didn't know anything about the people here. I didn't know anything about the city. I didn't know anything about the museum itself. But when I heard of Zaha Hadid, I got really excited that this is her architecture and it would be fantastic to work within that space. And when I came here, so I found really, like, it was very inspirational for me. In the beginning, we were thinking of borrowing a lot of work and exhibiting it here in the museum, but I thought it was a less exciting thing for me because the architecture itself is so powerful and the scale of different things, different objects here, it's so massive that one feel really small in this space. So I thought maybe I should make, my medium is very much related to the organic materials, organic, the procedure is very organic. I was trained as a miniature painter, so everything is very different. Whereas the museum itself is so massive, it's very concrete, it's very steel concrete, and the scale. So I thought I have to speak my really fragile, very, very organic, small medium in front of this massive thing. And it was a challenging, I took it as a challenge. So the first thing which just made me move was this large-scale window at the corner, two large-scale windows. For I immediately related it with the two pages of manuscript, the Islamic manuscript, or the tradition of manuscript in miniature painting. So I thought that I should make a small manuscript in response to this big manuscript, and it's talking to the to this large-scale window, which is already here.
The windows in the corner resemble an open book.
Yeah, it is. And the when I said this thing to the Allison, she said that, oh, we never read this window in that way. And they started looking at it into it with a completely new thing. So the miniature, the small manuscript format miniature, which is lying here, it's basically I have followed the layout of the window exactly. And I have made a beautiful decorative border around it. It looks very exotic. It looks very decorative, but then there is something else happening in this painting, which is a kind of, when I'm looking, I'm standing here, I just see the sky through the window, but when you look into the miniature, you see other things as well, which is happening around us these days. So it's that kind of, I think, dialogue or connection happening here.
The centerpiece here is, for want of a better description, a mountain of paper. There are 28,000, I understand, crumpled pieces of paper. Tell me about what inspired you. It almost appears that you walked into this room and wanted to fill the geographic space of this room in a fashion. Is there something to that? Did this room inspire this piece?
I think I did this piece before as well. I did it in Lahore, I did it in Berlin, I did it in Macro Museum, Rome, and then I did it in UAE, Dubai. So this is fifth time that I have done this piece here, but it speaks completely differently here because you see, I saw the wall is like it's falling down towards outside, and I made my piece, it's just trying to it's pushing the wall basically. So it's a small, these are the paper with the image of blood on it, foliage on it, which is again very fragile medium, but when they come to such a big quantity, they become so powerful that they are even pushing that huge massive thing. So, and people can even walk around it, and when you go behind the mountain and you walk through the through that space, there is a kind of strong dialogue with the wall and wall itself, window, sky, and the piece itself. So, and this piece is called And They Still See Traces of Blood, and which is about people, which is about when some incident of violence happened, this is the common people who suffered with it, but immediately when the incident happened, the common people are asked to stay away from that whole thing. And these are the officials or institution who investigate, and we didn't know that we are getting the true story out of it. We are getting the correct reason for that incident. So here the people who made this thing, who were allowed to touch it, who can investigate at their own, and they can make their own narrative, they can make their own whole theory out of it.
When you walk around this piece, you actually find yourself on the far side of it, walking under the paper because of the way it leans. And so I wanted to ask you about the challenges of constructing this so that it would stay up.
I think Brian, who is the mainly the in charge of the technical side of the museum, he was amazing. I said I want to do this thing in this way, and he came up with so many options, ideas. And when I arrived, there was a massive support kind of thing which was already there. There's nothing inside the whole mountain, but just the very little cables which are just holding the whole paper structure. And he made this arrangement on such a large scale that when I saw it, I didn't say anything to anybody, but from inside I was a bit nervous because I haven't done such thing on such a large scale, and I was not sure how I am going to deal with this challenge. But I'm happy that with the cooperation of people and everybody, and we managed to make it.
I also want to ask you about Fragmented, your work that is on the sidewalks and streets of East Lansing. Why did you agree to do that is the first question, because you're already quite busy here with this installation inside the Broad Art Museum. Was there something about the city that inspired you to say yes to this invitation?
I think I was really crazy busy when I was working on for this exhibition as well as on other projects. And 2-3 weeks ago, in a meeting, a Skype meeting, Allison and Jane, they asked me from the museum, they said that the mayor is really interested that you should do something, you should contribute even a small thing to the city in relationship to this exhibition. And I thought maybe if they are asking, they really want me to do this thing, I was not able to say no at all. I said whether I will do very little thing, but I will contribute something to this. But when I came here and I started working, it was not that small. I got really inspired with the city, the environment, working so publicly, which I have never done before. So it was an unusual experience for me.
You had people walking around you, vehicles going by you, laying in the street to do this work?
Yeah, it was really interesting that I was not feeling comfortable when I started off working on it, because I have done a lot of public pieces before for public exhibitions, but they were not that public when I was making them. Those were my space, those were restricted when I was working, and nobody can enter in that space without my permission. But here it was like, this is the city and you are working in one of the corner and you cannot stop anyone. So people were just immediately responding to that thing. They were immediately giving their comments, and it was amazing. And after 2 days, I was very comfortable working in that environment.
You wound up incorporating some of that activity into the work. Tire tracks, footprints were incorporated in the work. Rather than clean them up because it damaged your work, you put them to work in this piece.
Yeah, because I always take challenges in my art practice. If you see coming from the miniature tradition and just doing this mountain or the installation in the city, this is one of the example for this. But when I throw the paint in one of the part of the city, there was a truck who just crossed the whole thing very casually, and there were tire marks. So everybody who were with me for the technical support, they were worried that, this has, like, now we have to remove this and we have to clean it. But I was also surprised to see this attitude, that he was so casual, he was so, this is what it is happening with us, that we are so much used to these kind of violent, to see these kind of violent things in our life. And this was the best example of such thing, that it was red paint which just looked like the blood, and he crossed his truck. So I used that whole phenomena in my work.
We should explain for people who haven't seen it that when you first approach Fragmented, it looks like there's been a slaughter, a massacre, red paint resembling blood. But as you get closer and examine it more closely, the detail that you've added to that makes it turn into a beautiful red floral design that shows that there's beauty inside.
Yeah, the idea is that there is a lot of violence, but yet there is hope. And there are a lot of people who really wants the peace, who really love the hope in my part, in your part, everywhere in the world. So this is about that.
Imran Qureshi's The God of Small Things is inside the Broad Art Museum, and Fragmented is on the sidewalks and streets of the city of East Lansing. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl.
Well, it's throughout the hour today, we have been hearing the sounds of Ben Hassinger on ukulele, the founder of Mighty Uke Day and Citizen of the World, Andy Wilson on ukulele and harmonica, and Steve Zalige on upright bass. They're all here playing to commemorate the fourth annual Mighty Uke Day here in Lansing, which starts tomorrow. We're going to hear them perform Jamaica Farewell now. Ben, Andy, and Steve Zalige on Current State.
Nights are gay and the sun shines daily on the mountaintop. I took a trip on a sailing ship, and when I reached Jamaica, I made a stop. But I'm sad to say I'm on my way. I won't be back for many a day. My heart is down, my head is turning round. Had to leave a little girl in Kingston town. Sounds of laughter everywhere, and the dancing girls sway to and fro. I must declare my heart is there, though I've been from Maine to Mexico. But I'm sad to say I'm on my way. I won't be back for many a day. My heart is down, my head is turning round. Had to leave a little girl in Kingston town. Andy Wilson! Cry out while on their heads they bear. Ackee rice, salt fish are nice, and the rum is fine any time of year. But I'm sad to say I'm on my way. I won't be back for many a day. My heart is down, my head is turning round. Had to leave a little girl in Kingston town. But I'm sad to say I'm on my way. I won't be back for many a day. My heart is down, my head is turning round. Had to leave a little girl in Kingston town.
Ben Hassinger, also Andy Wilson and Steve Zalige here commemorating Mighty Uke Day in Lansing. The fourth annual begins tomorrow. And we're going to learn more about that right now. Ben Hassan, it's welcome to Current. Welcome back
Thank
to Current
you.
State.
You thanks guys are, for having us. We're so excited to be back again.
Half of the Mighty Uke Days you have commemorated on Current State.
That's
Think
true.
About it. You've
and
been here
we'd
twice.
We'd like to make it an annual tradition.
What is the allure of the ukulele? All three of you guys play.
Sure.
We can probably get an answer to that.
Well, you know, I mean, in my opinion, there's a few different things. One, it's a very accessible instrument. You can get a decent ukulele for a reasonable price, under $50. You can spend much, much more than that, but you can get a playable instrument for $50. And you can get some immediate gratification playing it. Anyone that's tried to play guitar, it's often been quite a long, painful process trying to get all those strings pressed down, trying to get that chord to sound right. I can take someone and teach them three ukulele chords in about 15 minutes, and they can start playing songs right away. And it's fun to play in a group of people. You hardly ever see one person sitting in a corner contemplating their navel with an ukulele. They're usually together with a group of people singing together and having a great time.
Yeah, years ago, when Steve Martin used to play his banjo in his stand-up act, he always said that there was something about the banjo that made singing about tragedy impossible. I mean, you're guaranteed to avoid any depressing subject if a banjo is involved. I'm thinking the same thing might apply to the ukulele.
The ukulele definitely has a pretty happy sound.
Yeah.
There are certainly depressing songs, and you play plenty of minor chords on ukuleles, but somehow it just doesn't seem quite as bad when you're playing an ukulele.
It's so portable as well. Does it weigh 2 pounds? I mean, does it weigh a pound? I mean, it looks like it's nothing at all.
Yeah, quite light. You know, the thing with an ukulele is because it is small, it has a thinner top, they don't usually brace it as heavy as a guitar. The lighter the uke, generally you get a little more full sound.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Now, your website mentions the unique ties of the ukulele to Michigan culture.
Well, didn't you know that Michigan was the great uke state?
I did not know.
You missed out on that somehow.
I missed
Mark,
that.
Come
missed
on.
That. Tell me about that.
Well, what's interesting is, you know, it was kind of a joke when we first started that little saying. But then as we dug into it, there is quite a bit of a history. The famous song Waikiki that Rich Cummings wrote, it was written in a hotel room in Lansing, Michigan. And I think it was 1937 or something like Andy Cummings. I'm sorry. And he was on tour. He was here like in January or February. It was one of our wonderful Michigan winters. And he went back to his hotel room after walking home from the gig in the cold. And all he could think about was the beautiful beaches of Waikiki and the palm trees. And he wrote this famous Hapaholi song called Waikiki. That's one of the standards. Gibson Musical Instruments made plenty of wonderful ukuleles in Kalamazoo back in the day. And we also have pretty much one of the biggest ukulele stores in the world right here in Lansing. Elderly Instruments, believe it or not, has a huge amount of ukuleles. We got some great luthiers in Michigan. Dave Talsma built some incredible ukuleles. In fact, Greg Hawks from the Cars, who's quite a ukulele player, plays a Talsma ukulele.
Okay.
And now with Mighty Uke Day, it's just we've kind of really cemented that whole ukulele tradition in Michigan.
And let us not forget Gary Zimnicki, who's now making ukuleles out of recovered Detroit homes.
Yeah.
Oh, my.
That's right. There was just an article on that.
Very neat project.
Well, this is the fourth annual Mighty Uke Day. Tell us some of the things you got planned.
Oh, my goodness. I thought we only had a few minutes, Mark.
Tell us about the Friday night concert first.
We've got Friday night. We do have our Michigan, the Great Uke State Concert. And we're featuring artists from Michigan. We'll have Andy and his wife Juliana. They have a duo called the Springtails.
Yep.
And Magdalene Fossum, who's now a whopping 13 years old and has the soul of one of these old traditional folk singers. And she's been playing the uke for years, like at the Ark and Wheatland and all these places.
She's an old soul.
An old 13-year-old soul. She's amazing. She's absolutely amazing.
And where does all this, what's the focal point geographic? This is an old town?
It's all
where
in Old
is
Town.
This?
We love having this in Old Town. A lot of ukulele festivals are self-contained in like a conference center. And we love the energy of Old Town. And our attendees give us great feedback. We love walking around to all the shops and all the different venues. So it's Elderly, the Creole Gallery, the Micah Gallery, the Old Town General Store, Proust Pets, Sir Pizza. It's all over the place, all around Old Town.
And the website where people can really dive into what's going on when is
MightyUkeDay.com.
Okay, easy
and
enough.
And our Facebook page, too.
Okay. You've also started a nonprofit called Music is the Foundation. What is that all about?
Well, this kind of grew out of Mighty Uke Day. And last year was our first big year. We had James Hill, who's one of the top players in the world. And with generous silent auction donations from manufacturers, we raised some money that we used to start an ukulele program for Sheridan Road School in Lansing, 4th, 5th, and 6th graders. And we've had a couple gigs now. We're getting pretty good. It kick-started a seniors group in East Lansing with the East Lansing Primetime Center and also helps fund a Guitars in the Classroom program in the Lansing schools, which helps bring more music into the classrooms by teaching the classroom teachers how to play ukulele and guitar and use it to enhance their lessons and have some fun with their students.
That sounds like a lot of fun for a really great cause. We want to thank all of you guys for coming back for the second year in a row. Ben Hassinger, Citizen of the World, founder of Mighty Uke Day, but mostly of Meridian Township. Andy Wilson and Steve Zolaiji, have fun this weekend. I hope it all
goes. Thank you. Have a blast. It starts at noon on Friday and goes through to Sunday. So
okay. MightyUkeDay.com. That's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, we'll sit down with MSU Law Professor Mark Totten to talk about why he wants to be Michigan's next Attorney General. Will also look into unpaid internships and their repercussions. That and more tomorrow here on Current State. What are you going to play us out with?
Well, since there's a new movie out, we better play this song. It's called The Theme from Spider-Man.
I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State.
1, 2, 3, 4. Spider-Man, Spider-Man, does whatever a spider can. Spins a web any size, catches thieves just like flies. Look out, here comes the Spider-Man. Is he strong? Listen, bud, he's got radioactive blood. Can he swing from a thread? A look overhead. Hey there, there goes the Spider-Man. In the chill of night, at the scene of a crime, like a streak of light, he arrives just in time.